David Ian Howe, thanks so much for coming on to Talk Beliefs. You are an archaeologist based in Georgia, United States, and your specialty is ethnocynology, which is the study of wolves and dogs in human cultural contexts. But before we start, can you just give us a brief overview about you and how you got into this pretty amazing subject?
Yeah, actually. So as a kid, I always loved history and evolution. And I originally went to school for history and ended up like, kind of being, oh man, what do I do now? And then I took an anthropology class and I was like, wow, here's history, prehistory, evolution all in one class. And I took that and then ended up getting my master's in it in archaeology. Or I guess my master's is in anthropology as well. It's a four field subject. And in grad school, I kind of got really fascinated by a couple articles I had read about dog burials and human canine connection in the past. And I thought it was super fascinating, and I just started looking into it, and it's not a widely studied thing. I mean, people love ceramics, people love like bones, things like that, but the history of the dog in humanity hasn't really been touched on by many archaeologists, so I decided to start looking into it, compiling some research, and I started that Instagram at ethnocynology, and I found out that that's a word, so I looked into that. And just like promoting research on that and currently working with TED Ed. They're producing a video. It should be out soon.
Right. That's the history of dogs, isn't it?
Yeah.
David, can you elaborate on the word ethnocynology, which is not a word you hear that often? How exactly would you define it?
So it's a neologism neologism founded by a Canadian archaeologist or anthropologist by the name of Brian Cummings. And it's just ethno meaning like people, and then cynology being the study of dogs, and it's the study of dogs in human cultural contexts. And I had always assumed like anthro canid apology or anthro lupine apology, something weird. And I'd proposed it in a paper or two, but then I stumbled upon that word and I was like, that's perfect, because we have like ethnography or ethnohistory, and then ethnocynology, the study of people and dogs, I think is pretty cool. I'd like to put that more into like the world lexicon, if as it were.
I think everyone knows that dogs were domesticated from wolves like thousands of years ago, but how do we think that that happened, and how long ago did this all start?
There's tons of theories on that. History of dogs and humans goes back quite a while. It's the first domesticated animal that humans had or encountered, and there's many working hypotheses on how it happened. But the leading hypothesis that I subscribe to is that we are just a very similar species ecologically. When humans first entered Eurasia, wolves were already there for thousands of years and existing as a top apex predator. And humans being this like ruthlessly efficient and invasive really species that came out of Africa, or at least into the greater Eurasia area, interacted with these animals, and there was just competition. And instead of wolves either had to, you know, go extinct, which probably wouldn't have been the case, but their population would have dwindled, and humans just being what we are kind of just dominate the earth wherever we go. Wolves just kind of formed an ecological niche, and that's what the dog is. And it's just they learn to live alongside humans, and they learn to scavenge instead of hunt. Or for the most part, dogs can still hunt. But wolves would start scavenging human camps, and they would start the more docile wolves would have more of a predisposition to hang around people more, whereas like the more aggressive or fearful ones would have run away. So over the millennia, these dogs that were allowed to stay around human camps that obviously weren't killed by the humans, or at least maybe after a while people started to name the dogs like, oh, that's old White Fang that comes near here once in a while, he's nice enough. And they let them stay. Over like millennia of natural selection, and in some cases artificial selection, because there's other theories that humans may have been adopting wolf pups, which isn't as likely, but we can't say for sure how it happened all over the old world. But anyway, wolves kind of adapted to life around humans, and the dog is the natural evolutionary niche that came out of that scavenging behavior of wolves.
So I suppose you couldn't say exactly when this happened. Was it 20,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago? And it probably happened in more than one place as well.
Absolutely. So interestingly, we have the first genetic date we know of, like, this is officially a dog, is around 15,000 years ago in East Asia. And we know that based on just genetic samples that have been taken all over the world, we know that probably what we know as a dog now in the modern world was there and present around 15,000 years ago. However, there is there's very morphological and evolutionary differences between a dog skull and a wolf skull. So when archaeologists find this, at a certain point, we see just a myriad of wolf skulls in the record. And then we see at around 10 to 15,000 years ago, dog skulls everywhere. But the question is, where does this like morph start? And we start to see this trend in, like, it's called domestication syndrome, where, like, a wolf skull is much longer. It starts to become shortened and more stocky when it becomes a domestic animal. And you can see that in sheep and goats and cows and all those things.
It becomes cuter, in other words.
Yeah. It's a form of neoteny, actually, which is scientifically meaning that you have cute traits. But, yeah, so we start to see this shift towards smaller and more domestic wolf skulls around 33,000 years ago, I think, is the oldest one. And that's in, I want to say, the Altai Mountains in Russia. There's three old sites. Some are 33,000, some are 30,000. And there's some in the Siberian mountains of the Altai Mountains, I should say, which is in the Russian Siberia. And then there's also some in Belgium and Goyette Cave. And I believe there's some in Germany. And we see these all over. But the very first dog that we know that was buried with a human was around 14,000 years ago in Germany. That's the Oberkassel dog. And then, which I think you had shared on your Evolution Soup page as well.
Yes.
And there's also another one, an Ein Malacha, or Ein Mahala, I can't remember how you say that, in Israel. And that was a woman buried with a puppy. That was around 10,000 years ago. But for sure, we know dogs were in existence living with people at least 15,000 years ago.
Wow, that's so interesting. David, well, here on Talk Beliefs, we talk about beliefs, obviously, especially religious beliefs and why people believe things the way they do. Animals appear in religious mythology all throughout the ages, and dogs seem to have a special place alongside humans in those myths. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. I would say so, all over the world.
I'm thinking of lycanthropy and werewolves, at least.
Yeah. So one thing that I've always found fascinating with that is, I mean, we have, like, at least in the Western canon, we have, like, this sense of the big bad wolf. And obviously we hunted them almost to extinction in a certain part, that they're a nuisance and a fearful animal to humans. But we have things like the werewolf, or we have, like, obviously, like, Fenrir is supposed to be a very scary wolf that lives with Odin in the afterlife and things like that, or lives in, you know, Valhalla, or in one of those astral planes. I can't actually quite remember. So we have all these fearful wolves, and I think part of what that is comes from the evolutionary standpoint of humans are persistence hunters, and which means that we don't have, like, the jaws of a bear or a wolf, and we don't run as fast as a cheetah, but what we do is we chase an animal and we sweat to, like, let our excess heat out, which is also why we're hairless, and we don't have to stop to pant, and we just keep chasing and chasing until that large ungulate, say like a deer, becomes exhausted and collapses, and then we get to the carcass. However, wolves do a similar thing. They don't sweat, they pant, but they're very persistent hunters. They chase and chase and chase, and, like, will stop and keep going. And I think in human evolution, that's a very, like, seated thing in our minds, that, like, wolves are terrifying because they do something similar to us. So all over the world, you start to see these beliefs and religions sometimes about dogs and wolves being, like, a fearful creature. And I think it comes from that.
Well, so sort of a perceived kinship right from the get-go, really.
Yeah, like an ancient rivalry, I would say. Yeah.
And I always think of the many-headed dog, Cerberus, is it, in the Greek myths?
Yeah, so Cerberus was the three-headed dog in Greek and Roman mythology. I think he had a different name in Roman, I can't quite remember. But he guarded the underworld, or Tartarus, in the Greek world, from people escaping. So he would guard the river, and he wouldn't let people, like, their souls leave the afterlife. The Aztecs had a similar belief that there was a dog that led you to the afterlife. Many Native Americans believed the same. The North American or North Alaskan Inuit also believed that the sea goddess lived underwater and was guarded by a dog. So there's Anubis as well, was the Egyptian god of, I don't think he's the god of death, but he was, had something to do with the underworld or the afterlife. And he was a golden-headed jackal, but some people believe he was also a wolf or a dog, depending on the depiction. And either way, there was some canid that had something to do with the afterlife. And we see this all over the world. And in Norse mythology, Fenrir is supposed to swallow the world during Ragnarok. So it's like a just super interesting cross-cultural connection there, with dogs being something associated with the afterlife.
Yeah, and I remember when you were on the Seven Ages podcast, they mentioned about the Christian saints that were depicted with the heads of dogs back in the Middle Ages. What was that all about? Do you know?
I actually can't recall what exactly that was about, but there are many Christian saints that had dog heads, and that's like a similar thing around the world. It just, there's just something in human like culture that associates dogs with the afterlife, and the Christian faith either picked that up from other pagan beliefs and things like that, like have they done in the past, or it's just something that people in the past had associated with death, and it just meant that at the time, you know.
Wow. Well, you and your colleagues have cataloged hundreds of dog burials across the United States, especially I think it's the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes dogs are buried along with humans, as you said, but more often just on their own. And as you said, this probably has something to do with the afterlife, I would guess. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's a question I get quite often. And it's like, why are these dogs buried with people? And the question is, like, without a time machine or the TARDIS, like, we can't find out, you know? So we do know that people were buried with their dogs, and of any animal that humans are buried with, dogs are the most common. Like, there might be towards like the earlier end of history or the later end of history where we are, there might be like people buried with horses and hamsters and things like that. But back in the day, it was mostly dogs. And the question I get a lot is like, was the dog sacrificed? And without direct evidence on the bones for like cut marks of butchery, like we can't necessarily tell if the animal bled out from like having its like throat slit or just some kind of sacrificial action. We can't necessarily tell unless it was like a huge trauma paleopathologically. But we can definitely tell that if it was a puppy, it probably was killed, to live or to be with the human in the afterlife in some kind of way like that. And I think that's pretty fascinating, that like people were being buried and intentionally, which is a human milestone in itself, to bury somebody with cultural artifacts and to put them in the ground in a certain way, to preserve them or to prepare them for the afterlife, and that they willingly sacrifice the dog to put them with them, or a puppy, so that they could be in the afterlife. That's a very powerful thing to me.
I mean, it makes sense because in everyday life, the dog is a companion and a protector. So it would make sense that they would choose their dog, perhaps their pet, who's protected them, guided them, helped them in this life, to bring them over to the next life. Because I know it's either, I think you've said before, that dogs are in the afterlife, they're either spiritual protectors, or they will, in a couple of cases, they will block a soul trying to get to the afterlife. So like a guard dog.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't want to misquote and say it was the Aztecs, but there was some Mesoamerican religion that believed that there was a dog that judged you when you went to the afterlife, kind of like Cerberus, or that just sat in the entranceway to it. And if it liked you or disliked you, it would like determine how you, like, you know, fared in the afterlife. And obviously, like, if a dog doesn't like somebody, they might not be a great person. There's something like that. I think that answers your question, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I'm sure that those Native American cultures had some strong beliefs surrounding wolves and dogs. Am I right in saying that? Or?
Yeah. So one of my favorite ones, which is kind of quite poetic, the Iroquois, and I believe it was directly the Seneca Iroquois of Western New York, believed that, you know, during like creation or like the time when the world was created, that humans and dogs, or actually humans were given humanity and made humans. So the other animals were made into animals, but the creators or the gods didn't know where to put dogs. They lost their chance to be human because they were promiscuous and filthy, I think is what the quote said. But they weren't able to be animals, and they were stuck between humans and animal. And humans kind of took pity on them and decided that there's no place for this animal to go, so they took them in, and that's why they live with us. And in exchange, if you show a dog great love or care for it well, you'll be given good magic or good karma, in a sense, which is called Arenda. And if you were to mistreat the dog or treat it in the wrong way or disrespectfully, you would get bad magic, which the way I interpret it was some kind of karma system.
They actually think that this dog here has a human soul, and perhaps it's because when you look in a dog's eyes, it does look like it's almost human,
Yeah, the Inuit as well. Many tribes and groups believed that once you gave something a name, it had a soul, and they had obviously the sled dog culture, and most of their dogs were forced to be sled dogs their whole lives and worked and slept outside. They were given scraps. But one dog was allowed to live with the family, and the dog that was allowed to live with the family was treated like a child, like we would in Western society. And it was given a name, and therefore it had a soul. There's something there with, which I can get into later. When you look at a dog, there's a very evolutionary connection we have with them, face wise, and how we recognize humanity in a sense.
And that leads very well to my next question, which is about evolution, which we talk about quite a bit on Talk Beliefs, or especially about the beliefs surrounding evolution. I know, David, like me, you know the importance of evolutionary science and that there is a pushback from creationists and those who just won't accept that mountain of evidence for evolution. So you've written papers, blogs, you have your ethnocynology Instagram account, you've done a few videos. What sort of pushback have you received from people who are skeptical of science and evolutionary science in particular?
One thing that I've gotten before, and I remember this standing out to me when I think I was even in high school when I got this before too, because I was always just obsessed with archaeology. There was a mammoth that was found in the backyard of someone's home in Franklin, Tennessee. And I was explaining that to somebody when I was in college, and that the mammoth was from 11,000, 10,000 years ago. But somebody was like, well, the world's only 6,000, and something like that. Yeah. And I never stomp on those beliefs because it's their beliefs. I respect that. But I just, as a scientist, try to explain it in the most logical and, factual way that I can, because that's just how I perceive the world, and to not just accept it because of what's written in a book is a little odd to me. But I've had that before, and that was a mammoth. But also telling people that dogs have been around for 15,000 years is a big number for some people.
Oh yeah.
And dogs are a touchy subject too, because I've met many creationists that love their dogs and totally are locked in when I give these lectures, and if I'll give those dates and say these things evolution and whatnot, when I'm up on stage, I can't tell if they're mentally checking out or not and things like that. But I've had people talk to me about that, and I just have to explain. I had someone argue with carbon dating with me at one point too. They don't necessarily accept it. And I if you don't accept it, that's where I kind of draw a problem. But if you don't understand it, then I'm more than happy to explain it. And because I didn't understand it for the longest, it's a complicated process, but to just outright say no is a little off to me. And I've definitely, on the other hand though, when I explain the history of dogs and the evolution of dogs, then the overwhelming evidence that Darwin was if anyone's watching who's read The Origin of Species, you'll know he was obsessed with domestic animals and plants.
Pigeons especially, yeah.
Especially pigeons. The whole book, I probably says pigeon more than the word the. But he finds dogs fascinating, and he wrote a book, I think, on the domestic animals or something like that. And can't remember the exact title. But he was fascinated by dogs. But anyway, back to what I was saying, when I explain this, the historical and evolutionary process behind dogs, and just bombard with the overwhelming evidence of how they're living evolutionary beings, I notice that some people will give a a nod of like, huh, in the audience. And like, I enjoy that because to me that means I'm teaching, you know. But in those moments, I can see people being like, that does make sense. And when I get that across in a crowd, like I said, I feel good because I'm teaching, but also like I might be using practical evidence that people can tangibly see and literally feel through like chemical reactions when they interact with dogs that like, okay, evolution might be something I understand now.
Absolutely.
And yeah, that to me is what it's all about.
And what about transitional fossils? Does that come into it? Transition fossils relating to wolves and dogs? Does that ever come into your...
Not since I've studied the dogs, but I've definitely had some interesting talks about the Cambrian explosion and transitional fossils and like how does that work, you know, if they just like appear, there's no transitional fossils and things like that. But again, when I was giving the talk a few weeks ago, I remember seeing, actually this is one a few months ago, talking about the transitional fossils, and I literally pulled out a skull of a wolf and a skull of a dog and was explaining how that works like on the screen. It wasn't like a physical one. What the differences are, and when I explain that, you know, this is a wolf and this is a dog, and have just spent 40 minutes explaining that they're the same species, the dogs are just an evolved subspecies of the dog, and then showing how that skull transitions to a smaller thing makes sense. And it's a gradual process that happened. And in the sense of, you know, grand evolution, dog domestication was like super quick. But that's what the process of evolution is. It's just accelerated evolution. Or domestication is accelerated evolution through artificial selection. But yeah, showing that just tangible evidence where they can go see a dog and go see a wolf at the zoo, it's there, the evidence is there, and I think it's a very tangible, hands-on science, scientific fact that they can see and can't really refute.
Okay, I just got to ask you, David, what did you think of the recent film Alpha? Now, this was a movie that came out last year, and it depicted the beginning of the domestication of wolves, revolving around the relationship between a wolf and a young hunter in the upper Paleolithic age, around 20,000 years ago, thereabouts. So do you think they got it basically right or wrong or
what? Yeah, that's a great question, because I had been pumped about this movie for a while, and I was like, oh man, it's going to suck. Like, it's going to be like 10,000 BC all over again. And then I went in, no offense to 10,000 BC fans, but I went...
Or worse, 1 million years BC. You ever seen that film?
No, I haven't seen that one. So I went in expecting to hate Alpha, and I even posted on my Facebook, like, is watching Alpha, and I was like, ready to be disappointed. And I left the theater, like, I got popcorn and a Coke doing the American thing, and I was like, oh, that's going to be good. And I loved it. It was... Their theories on evolution, like, I wouldn't say they presented as theories on domestication, I should say. They didn't present as scientific fact. It was just a joyful story of man and his best friend surviving the elements. It was, like, a very PG Revenant. But, yeah, it was great. Like, the costume design was fantastic. They got Salutrian culture down pretty well. How people would have lived in the Ice Age. There's even a scene where a guy was like eating ants off of his hand when they were hunting, which I loved because hunter-gatherers wouldn't have just been focusing on hunting a mammoth or a bison. They would have eaten whatever they could find. And they like little details like that they put in there. And the way the boy was hunting with the dog and how he would wound an animal, but the dog would run and chase it, or the wolf dog, I should say, that was accurate. And like, they did a great job. Whoever trained the wolf to be an actor was fantastic. There were some
they did their research on this one, apparently, then.
Yeah. Obviously. And I loved to meet the archaeologist who was their consultant, because he did a great job getting his point across. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's like, don't watch that movie and say, oh, that's how it happened. But it's definitely, if you want to get like a mental picture of what was going on back then, that's a good start.
Yeah, I love the film as well. Yeah. I've actually ordered it, so I'm waiting that to arrive, and I'm going to watch that and all the making ofs and everything all over again. Okay. Yeah. David, that was really great, really fascinating. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview. It was certainly a very different subject for me, and hopefully the viewers got a kick out of this. It's such an interesting topic, since pretty much everyone can relate to owning a dog or knowing somebody who owns a dog. So I guess the last thing I have to say is what is next for you? Are there any projects you can tell us about?
So I have the Instagram.com/ethnocynology, or the at ethnocynology is the handle. I also am starting a YouTube channel called How and Why Productions, and that's How with an E. I have one test video on there, but I'll eventually be uploading onto there. That'll be like the sister channel to my Instagram. I was doing a talk last week in, where was it? Augusta, at Augusta University. I gave one last year at the University of Colorado, or Colorado State University. There we go, in Fort Collins, Colorado. Yeah, and I plan to do more. I got the TED video coming up, and then I'm doing another talk in Nashville in a couple months. I'll email you when those details come up. Anybody that wants to reach out and ask questions, like, I'm always happy to answer. My email's on the Instagram. I'm sure Mark can put them out there.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely will. If people want to get in touch, so they probably will after this, want to ask questions, relate some stories. So that's fine for them to contact you.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't bombard, but yeah, I can get to it.
Okay, right. I will leave links to your ethnocinology website and Instagram in the description below. And other than that, I just like to say, David Howell, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it.